So we're sitting here to listen to Buddha's teachings. In fact, about bodhicitta, the Mahayana path, the bodhisattva path of the path to enlightenment, so that we can understand it intellectually, how it fits into the big picture, what it is, and how we cultivate it. And why? Because this is the marvelous qualities that are the characteristics, the unique characteristics of the bodhisattva. Wisdom, you know, emptiness, this is a Hinayana teaching. But bodhicitta, this is a unique one of the bodhisattva, the outrageous quality of the bodhisattva. So understanding this. I know you've done things already, so I'll probably repeat some things you know. Let's just talk about it in general, okay? So that we can really look into this and understand the logic of it and aspire to accomplish it, no matter how long it takes. It doesn't matter. So that we can finally achieve our own perfect potential for Buddhahood for the sake of all suffering sentient beings. This amazing attitude of the Bodhisattva. Thinking like this. Sangye chadam soke chong nam la jang cho baru dag ni kyab su chi dagi chan yen gi pe sonam ki drola penchir sangye drobha shok. Sangye chadam soke chong nam la jang cho baru dag ni kyab su chi dagi chan yen gi pe sonam ki drola penchir sangye drobha shok. Sangye charam soke chognam la jangcho baru dagni kyab su chi dagi chanyen gi pe sonam ki drola penchir sangye drobha shok. Actually, it's interesting, you know, talking recently and where I was in California, Land of Medicine Buddha, you know, talking about compassion, love, compassion, bodhicitta, all the components of the bodhisattva path, of the compassion wing of the path to enlightenment. But actually, you know, we think about compassion and love and it sounds kind of nice. Oh yeah, love, compassion, loving all sentient beings, having compassion, it feels easy. And then we think of emptiness and it feels like difficult. Well actually, I think the Lama say this, it's more difficult to realize bodhicitta. And you listen to, the words sound kind of nice, they're not sounding complicated, like wisdom, you've got to squeeze your brain to understand emptiness. So compassion, the words sound easy. But when you analyze these words, they're insane. I remember when I first heard the teachings about bodhicitta, I thought these people were out of their brains, speaking all this stuff with a straight face. That you could have love and compassion. Just to say the words, have love and compassion for all sentient beings. You know, we say that those words. It's beyond, it's mad. If you go to your therapist and say, may I have a method, please, to love and have love and compassion for all sentient beings, they will think you're psychotic. It's beyond, there's no concept like that. So that's why our trouble is, as soon as we hear it in terms of spiritual, we kind of, it's cheap and easy to say it, you know. It feels like in the sky somewhere, oh yeah, far out, love and compassion for all sentient beings. Excuse me. Beyond outrageous, you know, these teachings. Absolutely beyond outrageous. Love and compassion. Not to mention bodhicitta. So first of all, you could say that, you know, in terms of the two wings of the bird, this nice analogy, which really is covering the entire structure of the path to enlightenment, the lamrim, basically. It's the point. In the end, this is the point. It's as if all the other work, all the work of understanding impermanence, realizing death and impermanence, understanding the suffering of all the lower realms, taking refuge, abiding by the laws of karma, understanding your mind, getting to the root of the delusions, knowing the main causes of suffering, all of this is just the preliminary practice to prepare us to eventually, actually, begin to cultivate love and compassion and bodhicitta and then become a Buddha. This is the point. All of it's just it's really preliminary. And already this is beyond outrageous, having the mind that can be utterly subdued and not follow delusions and have concentration and know your mind intimately well and don't harm sentient beings. This is already intense. But it's simply the preliminary practice for the real purpose of the path. you know, the compassion component, the love and compassion, the bodhicitta component. So, you know, especially when we look into the amazing approach that they take in the Tibetan tradition, which is coming from Shantideva, which is the more radical way of accomplishing bodhicitta, these two main tracks, two main methods for accomplishing bodhicitta. One is the six causes and the one effect, and then the other one is the one called exchanging self for others. This amazing, outrageous, over-the-top approach to accomplishing, method for accomplishing bodhicitta, the essence of which is the practice called Tonglen, you know, giving and taking. It's the main methods that all the great holy beings of Tibet have used, the most radical, the most dramatic. So as Pavongka Rinpoche says in the Lam Rim, you need to be a suitable vessel to hear these kinds of teachings, you know. That whole approach called, you know, Lojong, as they call it, mind training, all the radical approach to ripping out delusions, ripping out ego. And so, the techniques, you know, the packaging. There's one kind of classic packaging of the series of techniques that is the, you know, a method of accomplishing bodhicitta. That's a combination of the six causes and one effect. The first few points are coming from there, and then the second ones are coming from the more radical one of, you know, exchanging self for others. And then it turns into 11 little techniques. So the very first one of these is called equanimity, which you must have gone through all this before. You must have gone through all equanimity and everything, did you? Definition of bodhicitta, the difference between 7 point, there you go, 7 point cause and effect. There it is, that one you've done. So then you've got to do now, so this is what, this whole other approach, this one here, we're supposed to be talking about giving and taking. So one of the first points is this. The bottom line, from A to Z, the entire approach of the Buddhist path, you're doing exactly the same thing from the first second of junior school all the way to enlightenment. What you're doing is changing your mind. That's the job. Whether you're practicing tantra, bodhicitta, meditating on emptiness, watching your delusions, stopping harming others, the bottom line is you're working on your mind, because the mind is the point. The mind is full of delusions and neuroses that cause me all suffering, all realms of rebirth, and every sentient being is the same. So the job we're doing here is changing our mind, because Buddha says the main causes of suffering are in our mind. That never changes. He states that in the Four Noble Truths. Very clear. It's fundamental. It's the fundamental approach of a Buddhist. So you can put it like this, you know, when you do all the wisdom wing work, which is all about impermanence and karma is the essence of it, really. Abiding by the laws of karma, understanding karma really well, what are the causes of suffering, what is suffering, what are its causes, and how I apply that in my daily life. I refrain from harming others, I control my mouth, I control my body, and then I get more advanced and I become my own therapist and I do some concentration meditation and I get to know my delusions from studying the Buddha's model of the mind, and I begin to get to the root of the problem, get to the root of the problem. So all the time here you could say that the main problem is attachment. Effectively. It's not the root delusion. The root delusion is what's called ignorance that believes in the self-existent me, which is the cause of all samsara, period. When that's removed from the mind, that's the beginning of the end of suffering. You're now the first moment of being an Arya being or a superior being, and you can't fall back into samsara again. You've got more to go to finish, but you can't go back from the first second of your direct insight into emptiness. That's an amazing turning point for a person on the path. So effectively, in day-to-day life, the main problem is this bottomless pit of attachment, this bottomless pit of this incredibly, as we've been talking, this deeply ingrained dissatisfaction, the disease we bring into this life as a result of practicing attachment in the past. So what comes from dissatisfaction, of course, is more attachment. I must get this, I must get that. So the grossest level is the objects of the senses. And then more subtly, as is especially talked about in the Bodhisattva path, which we'll talk about, his attachment to the more subtle one, this packaging of the eight worldly dharmas, which is just another way of talking about eight different ways that attachment work, but at a subtler level, much harder to see until we've harnessed the gross level of attachment in terms of the objects, you know. Even though it's attachment, which is to do with the wisdom wing, it's talked about it on a more deep level in the Bodhisattva path. But effectively, in general, you could say attachment's the main problem. Desperate to get what I want every millisecond. This brings rise to anger and all the other garbage. So you could say attachment's the main problem. Now, in the compassion wing, it's talked differently. They talk here, as we all know, the main problem is what they call self-cherishing. A better word for it, it sounds like a nice word, I remember. The cherishing is a nice word, isn't it? So self-cherishing sounds quite pleasant. A friend of mine heard about a course on self-cherishing. She said, oh, what a good idea. I must learn how to cherish myself. She got a big surprise. So the better word for it in our culture, and this seems more cruel when we hear it, you're so selfish. That's another word for it. That's all it is. Selfishness is what meant by self-cherishing. Don't make it some cute Tibetan problem. Self-cherishing is a cute word for selfish. Putting me first. So you could put it this way. The root delusion is ego-grasping. It's a colloquial term for ignorance that clings to the self-existent me, which is the root of all samsara, all suffering. So because of this, there's attachment to get what I want. That's the way it's kind of framed in the wisdom wing. But when you're here in the compassion wing, the way the problem is framed, because of ignorance, we put me first. Which indicates the whole approach of cultivating compassion. Especially this radical approach of exchanging self for others. We're learning to put others first. We're learning to cherish others more than self. This is the whole approach that all these structured practices lead to that one. And that's the essence of which is Tonglen. So the framing of the problem is in it's framed in the Bodhisattva part as self. You know, the problem is called self-cherishing, selfishness, putting me first. And every one of those practices, if we look at the 11 techniques, which is the combination of the 7-1 and the exchanging self one, these two traditions put together, the whole point of everything, it's leading to finally, literally, make this paradigm shift and exchange self for others. And that's when it kicks into bodhicitta. When you've got that, that's what you get. That's finally, that kicks into bodhicitta. So another way of talking about it, you know, is this, you know, we hear the word compassion. And people like this word. It's wonderful. To even have a thought of compassion is incredible. To even have a thought of wanting others to be happy, which is love, it's incredible. As Lama Zopa says, even just have one kind thought is incredible, given the suffering of this world, you know. So let's look at what is compassion, what is love, how do we define them, what are they? Because there are many virtuous qualities we can see, generosity, forgiveness, you know. All these are good qualities, but you could say in the way that the path is structured here, it comes down, that's why it's called the compassion wing. It's all expressed, they're all enclosed, they're all included in when you've got compassion, you necessarily have all the other good qualities. It's a way of essentializing it, you know. All the good qualities come down to having, when you've really cultivated compassion. And again, remember, like all this Buddhist path, these terms are so precise, they each is their own level of development. They're really defined clearly, you know, that there are various indicators of exactly when you've achieved it. It's not just this wishy-washy vague feeling, which we certainly think when we think of love and compassion. In fact, usually when we think of love and compassion, we think of a feeling in the heart. Right, a moment of compassion, you know, you have tears for somebody. But it's really a very different approach here. It's learning, which is surprising to us. It's learning how to cultivate love and compassion. Step by baby step, incremental stages of inner development that culminate in the development of these things. And it's quite a surprise to us to hear this. We know there are courses. You can do courses in anything in our world. But all this is, if the compassion wing, the whole thing, exactly, a really rigorous incremental, step-by-step, clearly defined, graduated course that culminates finally in Buddhahood. But there are stages of development, you know, stages. And so one stage of development is the first moment of having accomplished bodhicitta. They're very clear. And so the method for, and this is what's interesting, we're surprised by this, the method for accomplishing these states of being, mind, is the same method as thinking about, as meditating on death and impermanence, the same method of thinking about or meditating on karma, the same method of thinking about and meditating on emptiness, using logic and analysis to argue with to argue with and break down ego's misconceptions. So that the way you cultivate love and compassion sounds very surprising to use logic and analysis to break down ego's misconceptions. We just think of some feeling, you know. We're not quite sure how you get it. Some people are just born with it, we think, and some people are just loving and compassionate, don't know why. But there are methods, step by baby step, step by baby step, really rigorous, really clear, starting with thoughts. So, okay, what is compassion? How do you define it? Well, it's a thought, bare bones, because everything comes down to being thoughts. Bare bones, definition of compassion is the thought, may you not suffer. So you see a person suffering, and you want them not to have it. You empathize with it. You wish they didn't have it. That's how you define, even you want to call it, a feeling of compassion. You think, you hear about people suffering, and it makes you sad, and you wish they didn't have it. That's compassion. So it can be quite small. And then, of course, it can grow to phenomenal degrees. The compassion of the bodhisattva is beyond comprehension in our world. There's nothing like it in our world. So love, what's that? It's the thought, may you be happy. Or you see a person happy and you're delighted. It pleases you. That's love and compassion. So we need to grow these to this phenomenal degree. Right now, as we talked about this on Sunday, I think, if you were here, I don't know, when we talked about equanimity. In this 11 stages, it's the first of the seven things, and it's the first of the combination of the seven and of this exchanging self for others. So there's 11 little techniques. And the first one, the foundation, without which you can't develop these things. And what it is this development of equanimity. Equanimity. So like all these words, it's a very common English word, but, you know, it's got a precise definition. Precise definition. Clear, very clear. And it's the absolute basis upon which is grown all the other realizations that culminate in love and compassion, which culminate in bodhicitta, which then eventually lead us to Buddhahood, combined with emptiness. So equanimity, when you've got it, when it's been accomplished, okay? Because we're aiming to accomplish it. When you've accomplished it, what it is this would be this spontaneous, you could say, heartfelt recognition that enemy, friend, and stranger are the same from one point of view. Their wish to be happy and their wish not to suffer. Even you could say the first one, their wish to be happy. This is something that Buddha would take as a starting point. He says, you observe sentient beings, do your market research in the universe, wherever you go, the ants, the dogs, the giraffes, the humans, you're going to observe. They want to be happy and they don't want to suffer. You can observe it, a fact. So this seems so simple, but it's outrageous. Even just equanimity is outrageous, I tell you, and it's the first. What is the implication of this idea that enemy, friend, and stranger are equal in the wish to be happy and not to suffer? What are the implications of this? Sounds nice, sounds easy, sounds simple. Well, they're outrageous, I tell you. So it's a recognition, and the method for getting it is using logic. The method for getting it is using logic to break down ego's misconception, neurotic, you know, the way we are right now. And it doesn't take long to intellectually prove it's true. So of course the starting point is to prove it's true logically, and then how you use that every day and in your meditation is to counteract the opposite, which is completely that we couldn't care less that everyone wants to be happy and doesn't want to suffer. So right now, in other words, what we think now, We have, okay, what have we got? We've got friends, enemies, and strangers. What's a friend? In terms of delusions now, by definition, a friend is an object of my attachment. So that person looks divine. I'm attracted to them because attachment, if attachment's in the mind, the object looks gorgeous and you run to it and you want it. So a friend, you know, is a person for whom we are, to whom we're attached. And depending on the level, of course, could be our divine new baby, could be our divine new husband, could be your new best friend, could be your old best friend. You still adore each other. Surprise, surprise. Friend is the object of attachment. So then, okay, then we have an enemy. And what, we might use that word in our lives, but it's a convenient label for the object of aversion. So the object of aversion, they look, the aversion makes them look ugly and you go away from them. Isn't it? Don't want to be near them. The more ugly, the more mean, the more you want to go away. The more you have aversion. The third one, of course, is a stranger. And that's, of course, as we pointed out, as we know, if we analyze, 99.99% of the universe are in that category. And how do we feel about them? Well, it's called indifference. So these are the three, these are the three main delusions, according to Buddhist psychology. They're the essence. Forget in terms of being beings, but in terms of anything. Objects we like, attracted to, objects we don't have attraction for, and the rest we couldn't care. And so this indifference that we have for strangers is a consequence of the deeper delusion called ignorance, which is this grasping at an inherent self, which brings this dullness of not caring about things that basically aren't affecting us. So you have indifference for a stranger because they've neither harmed nor helped you. You have aversion for an enemy because they have done things that are mean to you, or they think thoughts that you don't agree with, that they, you know, like the wrong politician or something. Or, and then you have a friend who, to some degree, some ways, is in sync with your ideas and feelings, you know, or more fundamentally, does the things that make you happy. This is the definition of these three, and it's very sobering to hear this. But of course, we don't think about this because the universe runs this way. Everybody has these three categories, and nobody questions it. We just think it's normal. And of course we don't question it, because this is Buddha's questioning the very fundamentals of the way the world works. These delusions, he says, are nonsense. These delusions are liars. These delusions lead us up garden paths. These are delusions of the cause of all the suffering. And so, of course, these three delusions create their own objects, friend, enemy, stranger. So, of course, what do we have towards friends? Well, as long as Oprah says, we do have some love. Aren't we fortunate we've got some love to temper this attachment? Because the fact is, if there's not much love, then you really see the grotesqueness of attachment and aversion. Then why the mothers murder their babies. And, you know, if you're completely involved in your own self, in your own world, totally caught up in selfishness, totally caught up in attachment, and you have no space in your mind for someone else. I mean, God, I mean, I always crack jokes and say, oh, if I had a husband and children, they would be dead. So just as well, I'm a nun. I'm sort of joking, but I'm not joking. Or I say, I'm glad my mother had attachment for me. She would have murdered me otherwise. So try and hear the point. It is sort of a joke, but it's not. Because you think about, you know. So the moment we do have love, and we do have compassion, but for whom? Only that one category. Unless we really work on it, and that's the whole point here, to try and work on it. We're looking at the normal world, you know. The default mode is you want to be happy only those, obviously, who make you happy. This is just normal. No one is surprised by this. But all Buddha's saying here, which is what Buddha's saying from day one to all the end, that these neuroses are limiting, they cause suffering, and they cause us to harm others, and hey what, baby, we can rid the mind of them. Which is the point in all of Buddha's practice. Not meant to be some goody-goody reason to do these things, because someone vaguely says we should. The fundamental point that Buddha's making from day one, which is so powerful for our minds to think about, is that our minds are fundamentally pure, meaning delusions, neuroses, unhappy emotions, they say in Buddhist psychology, they're adventitious. Believe me, it's not a word I use in my English, in my daily language, but you look it up in the dictionary and it says that something that's adventitious is not crucial, is not central, is not integral to that thing. So this is Buddha's insane point. It's the basis of all his practices, all his assumptions, all his methodology. The very the very assuming of Buddhahood. All of these are on the basis of Buddha's fundamental finding that delusions don't belong in the mind. They can be removed. So our idea of a normal person will be some attachment, some anger, some jealousy, some depression, but hopefully a bit more love and compassion and generosity. But there's no model in our culture that would dare to assert that this other stuff is absolutely fundamentally mistaken and all of it can be removed. There's no concept like this in our modern psychological world. None. So it's insane what Buddha's suggesting. So you must hear it this way. So therefore, all his techniques, as I said, from A to Z, are methods of incrementally removing from your mind the junk. That's all it is. It's not just being a nice person because somebody says you should. It's the work on your own mind of recognizing at each stage of your own inner development the delusions that cause you suffering and cause you to harm others, and the methods of getting rid of them. That's it. That's what it is, you know. So we do have love. How fortunate. But only for those who do what I want. In other words, who fulfill my attachment. And then we all perfectly well know the moment, you know, my friend gives me up for someone else, my beloved husband, you know, throws me out and gets someone else, then that's when love stops right there, usually, and turns into aversion. I mean, look at the world. This is clear. So we do have love, but as we'd say, it has strings attached. But as Lama's Opus says, it's unstable. So the job is, this equanimity, practice of equanimity, it's a very precise thing. It's not the development of love and compassion. It's not trying to forgive everybody. It's learning to use logic to see clearly that they're all the same. They're equal in their wish to be happy and not suffer. That's what equanimity is. And it's a very, very powerful realization. Even intellectually, it's very powerful. It can counteract 1,000 miseries a day, you know. I just sneeze. It's not coming. Might come later. Just in case one comes. Thank you. Thank you, darling. Thank you so much. So, equanimity. Okay. I better have a little blow. Can you turn me off? Oh, turn me off a minute. I'll turn me off. Okay, as I said, when you've got it, or are gradually stepping towards it, it's the recognition, the knowledge, the knowing that they're all the same from the point of view of wanting to be happy. But the getting of it, the way you get that, the way you come to that, is nothing other than using logic, showing, pointing out to us the absurdity of it, has got no base. And this is the point now. Okay, so now, what we're heading towards is wanting to love all sentient beings and have compassion for all sentient beings, as mad as it sounds. But that's where we're going. That's where we get to. And that's when, with Tonglen, we even do this more radical level of it where we actually put them first, not just love them all, but put them first, before me. So, we're heading towards that, okay. But right, so what Buddha's getting us to do in this method is change the logical basis for why we want people to be happy, that's called love, and why we want them to suffer, not suffer, that's called compassion. We've got to change the logical basis, and that's what you're doing with equanimity. So right now, I naturally run to my beloveds who are kind to me, and we know how blissful it is to have one person in our life even who hears us, who sees us, who respects us, who likes us. It's immense. So don't think we shouldn't have friends. It's marvelous to have this. It's wonderful to have this. But naturally, because they do what we want and they smile at us, what that triggers is the attachment in us, this bottomless pit of attachment, which is a deeper level in the eight worldly dharmas, which we'll talk about. This huge craving to be seen by others, to be heard by others, to be appreciated by others. This is a massive attachment, so deep in our bones, you know. So naturally, we will completely adore the person that says nice things to us, that appreciates us, that listens to us. Of course we do. We will love them to death. But all the point Buddha's making, and this is why it's so shocking, What he's saying is, Rabin, I'm sorry. Just because Mary is really kind to you is no logical reason to want her to be happy. And that's the point here. The default logic we use for why I love Mary is because she makes me happy. No one questions it. Even more shocking, basically what Buddha's saying is, I'm sorry, Rabin, it's just because Fred's a creep and he harmed you and he left you for a younger version, he cheated and lied and took all your money, is no logical reason not to want him to be happy. I'm sorry. Excuse me. I mean, it's beyond insane, isn't it? Because that is the absolute logic that we use. Think of the world. This is the perfect logic to not want Fred to be happy. The more mean is Fred, the more evil Fred is, the more I'm allowed to be full of rage. I'm allowed to hate him. I'm allowed to want him to suffer. To actually think, as a way of putting it, you know, what Buddha's saying. The Buddha's saying there's no logical basis whatsoever. You mean just because Fred raped you, you shouldn't... I know I always use dramatic examples, I'm sorry, but it's always helpful for the mind to hear a dramatic example. That's not a logical reason not to want him to be happy. This is too shocking for the mind, isn't it? Beyond insane. And then you hear a stranger. Well, Rabbi, just because they do neither for you, you know, there's no logical reason to not want them to be happy. This is what we're heading for. So... Well, I'm not joking when I say this stuff is outrageous. It's not difficult intellectually, like emptiness. But emotionally, this almost seems like impossible. Mad talk, you know. This is the degree to which Buddha says we can grow ourselves. And what it indicates is the depth of delusions, the depth of ego grasping. So totally, because the entire world runs this way, that of course it is never questioned. If we hear it in our world and we hear a person who's extra special, we say, oh, they're a saint. They're born like that, they're a special gift from God or something. But there's no idea that, oh, I'd love to be like that. No one, we think we admire Mother Teresa, we would admire the great saints, let's say. But we put them up in the sky. We don't think, wow, I'd like to be like that, how can I do a course on? Where's the course on how to become like Mother Teresa? We don't think this way. Because we think she's abnormal. And we're normal. You understand my point? So, I mean, for me, when I talk about compassion and love and bodhicitta, it blows my mind, I tell you. Emptiness seems easier to me. I'd rather play safe and talk about emptiness, I tell you. This stuff's over the top. We will talk equanimity here. Just to so what you're doing with equanimity, another way of talking about it. What you're doing to get it is you have to use logical arguments to see how absurd it is. And one of the big arguments they use is, well, you know, the enemy of today was the friend of yesterday. The friend of yesterday was the stranger of the day before. So the absurdity of how we keep changing the categories, changing the labels on the same people. One minute you completely would give your life for Fred because he did what your attachment wants, but now he doesn't do what your attachment wants, you wish he would die. Isn't it? I mean, isn't this how we are, you know? So even these are the kind of ways you think to make yourself put an egg on your face and realize what an idiot you are. You know? Because this is the emptiness one. There's no inherent enemy. There's no inherent stranger. There's no inherent friend. They're just labels. And this is the key point, again, Buddha's making across the board. All these labels we have, which appear absolutely real to us, are just the projections of a particular set of delusions. They're just projections which change according to my position in it, you know? So they're all utterly self-centered in their nature. Utterly self-centered. But this is, in the ordinary world, this would be considered beyond shocking to talk like this. Because it's when we look at the world for us, the ideal, almost like a mantra among most people, is that what life is all about, what happiness is, what the total goal of life is friends, and family and health. Family. And family, of course, is the essence of the one of friends, isn't it? They're the closest friends we have. Ideally, that's the fantasy, isn't it? Family means the absolute, I'm not being mean, you know, the objects of attachment. And they're the ones we devote our lives to, they're the ones we sacrifice our lives for, everything's family. That's the one, you know, people will kill for, they're the bottom line, they're the ones you give your life for. So we have this enormous talk of nobility, of love and compassion, but it's confined to that group. So then it's because it's such a huge thing in our culture and revered as so special. To question it and say it's deluded sounds quite shocking, you know. And even more shocking, I've got to have love for my enemy in the same way. I mean, this is what I'm saying. It's madness. So one of the first things, it seems, in what we're trying to do with equanimity is have this recognition that they're just labels, they're projections of our particular set of delusions. And, of course, there's attachment, aversion, and ignorance. There you go. Right there. And that's how come 99.99% of the universe. We don't know about them. We don't care about them. I mean, generally speaking, I mean, some of us have big hearts and we do care. But get the point, you know. They're not the ones we're concerned about. We don't even notice them. We don't even notice them, you know. They don't stay in our mind, a stranger. If you go to a party or a group or a thing or this, you know, the center, and you go to an event, even if it's 10 people, in a month, you'll remember the ones you didn't like and the ones you do like. You will not remember the strangers, the ones that did neither to you. It's a fact. That's by definition what a stranger is, isn't it? You don't remember what they look like, don't remember their name, don't remember what they were. You see their face and vaguely you might, oh yeah, I met you somewhere, you know. We think that, don't we? But an enemy has the same power for us as a friend does, don't they? We can't stop thinking about them. Except it's opposite, you know. So, you know, one of the first things that seems to me, if we think about the process of getting some equanimity, getting some stability in our mind, this recognition that they're equal in the wish to be happy and not suffer, is that we're sort of like getting ourselves out of the equation, stepping back out of these three. So even as we're talking, we can think of three people, you know, enemy, friend, and stranger. Friend to the left, enemy eyeball to eyeball in front, stranger to the right. So it's getting yourself out of it. And these different logical arguments you read in the Lamrim, the different arguments you can use to get us to see how this is, it's not complicated really, but it's a logical truth. Don't worry about feeling anything special. Feelings come later. The first step is to see the logic of it. I'm not kidding here. That's extremely important. So there's so many little arguments you can use for your mind. I mean, one of the ones I feel really most helpful, I think of friend, enemy, stranger, you know? Think in your own daily life currently, who annoys you, irritates you, whom you adore, and who you just don't, you know, the person at work you can't put their name to, you know? Because they're just indifferent to you. Whatever. The bloke down the road, whatever. It's really obvious. The technique for me is how to see that they're all the same from their point of view, how they feel equal in their wish to be happy and not suffer, which I can't see now, because I have no vested interest in seeing that. If I switch it around and I think of myself, I know very well when my friend looks at me, I'm the friend. You know, Fred sees a beautiful person, let's say. When Mary, who's my worst enemy, let's say, looks at me, she sees that she's looking at, and I can tell by looking, she's looking at me with daggers. So clearly she sees an ugly person. And the stranger's kind of vaguely looking at me, couldn't care less, you know. They don't see anything. You get my point here. So in that, I am the one person, but for this one I'm a friend, for this one I'm an enemy, and for this one I'm a stranger. Well, think about it. I don't suddenly change my feelings depending on who looks at me. I want to be happy every second. I don't want to suffer every minute. Whoever looks at me, whether I'm ugly or beautiful, who cares? I want to be happy, please. You see my point? We'll just switch it around, you know. But the biggest problem we have, of course, if we think, you know, you put the worst enemy in front, let's say you're a hated politician, there people love to hate certain politicians. You have all these reasons why you think he's horrible, he's got terrible politics, he's a this, he's a that, and you can't stand the politics, you can't stand their voice, you hear their voice, you hear their name, you freak out. Then you hear that Buddha says, oh, he wants to be happy, just like my beloved. The first thing we say is, but what do you mean, he doesn't deserve it? We don't even think about whether he wants to be happy, because the millisecond you think your worst enemy wants to be happy, straight away you make them human. Immediately there's a softening of the heart. You're not even wanting them to be happy yet, which is love. That comes five steps on. Just the scary recognition there's a real human being there, and in his heart, he wants to be happy. He's worried about how he feels. He's worried about his constipation. He's worried about what people think about him. He's worried about being overweight. He worries and stresses at night about his job. And suddenly, as soon as you say those words, you humanize the person, don't you? Do you understand? You stop seeing this object of your disgust, which you believe is the whole person. This doesn't mean he didn't harm you. Yes, everyone saw it. He harmed you. That's not the issue here. This is not the point. Because you see, we're so caught up in believing love is something that someone deserves. because it's based on attachment. And the aversion, hate, is what they deserve if they're mean to me. That's the default mode of samsara. So just why this is, even this point, starting point, is so shocking. To step out of the equation, don't look at what they've done, stop looking at whether they're nice people or ugly people. That's not the issue here. This is just not the issue, and that's what's so hard for us, because we are so caught up in our labels of people. We don't want, it just seems a bizarre idea to say that Hitler wanted to be happy. You understand? Or the most, you know, like if somebody just, you know, executed you. Or the person who murdered your daughter is being executed, no, is in prison. Well, he wants to be happy too. Because then a whole pile of things come on from that, and we think, this is not right. I can't think of a person like that, you know. I just can't think he wants to be happy. Because what am I supposed to do with that? And that's the point. What we're going to head to is wanting him to be happy, which is love. Love is easy when it's people you like. Love feels comfortable. Compassion feels comfortable when it's for victims. Little innocent animals, little innocent children. It's so cozy to have compassion. I'm not being horrible here. But this is where Buddha's over the top in his radical level to which we can and will and must, if we want to be a Buddha, accomplish love and compassion. It's way beyond the usual instincts of ego and attachment and the nonsense, you know. This is why I really mean it when I say this is really radical stuff. But it's so easy to say the words. They sound so nice and, oh, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. We say that every day. May I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. It's insane. I know I always sound extreme. I do understand that. Are we communicating here? So be humble, start small, delight in what you can accomplish, but know where you're heading and know the logic of how you can head there. That for me is so powerful, rather than just some sentimental gooey feelings you hope you might get one day, you know. That's just equanimity. I know I'm never going to finish this whole thing. How many days have we got on this topic? How many days do we have? Well, who knows what we'll do? I'm sorry, I mightn't cover all the things you're supposed to cover. I'm sorry, I don't know what. This is just discussing. So then, okay, so the equanimity. You got the clue about equanimity. The thought, the wish, no, the recognition that enemy, friend and stranger are equally wish to be happy and not suffer. It's not a complicated concept, but it's pretty outrageous. And to see how it's not to want them to be happy. Please don't mistake it. That's love and compassion, which you get five steps on. We're setting the basis for wanting to grow love and compassion stably, so it isn't just remaining for our group of beautiful people. We're getting beyond, we're seeing the logic of how it must be for every sentient being. So another one of the logics they use is, for example, the friend was the enemy was a stranger was the friend. And it keeps changing roles, so obviously it's not a very stable basis. One minute you think Fred's great and want to be happy, next minute you want to kill him. It has nothing to do with them, you know. They're just the same. Whether they're your enemy or their friend, there's no difference. And then, of course, more dramatically, they use the example of past lives. So always I like to quote that story of, you know, Shariputra, one of Buddha's main disciples, who was clairvoyant and realized emptiness, all this business, you know. And he's doing his arms round with his bowl. You know, they go around begging food. And he pokes his nose in this house. I think you always hear this story. I like this story. And he looks in. And he goes, the father nurses his enemy while he kicks his mother and eats his father's bones. What a farce samsara is. So what he saw with his eyes, he saw that with his clairvoyance, what he saw with his eyes was this bloke nursing his gorgeous baby, whom he could see with his clairvoyance was the reincarnation of the bloke down the road he'd murdered because he had raped his wife. Now he's his baby, cute little baby, my little best friend, you know. He's eating the fish, which is the reincarnation of his daddy, because he was attached to catching the fish in the back pond, who'd been born there. He's kicking his mummy, who's the dog, because she's eating the bones of her husband, because she died and was reborn as an animal there because she was super attached to the place. Now, okay, if Buddha's right about reincarnation, this is how it would be. So what a farce indeed samsara is. Not only you're in love with Fred yesterday, but loathe his guts today. Or the person could have dropped dead last week because they were a stranger and there wouldn't have been a blink in your life. Today you're having a mental breakdown because they're now your blessed friend. So it shows how everything is linked to our self-centeredness. It just shows it, you know. You didn't suffer remotely when the stranger down the road died, if he's a stranger. Because why? Because he hasn't affected you. But now he's your beloved, and you have a massive vested interest in him. Now you have a mental breakdown because he dies. This sounds so cruel to us, because it's questioning the fundamentals of normal life. And as Milarepa said, up in the mountains, laughing, as Lama Yeshe put it, he's up in the mountains laughing because he's seen the truth. And as Milarepa said, whatever the world does, the opposite is Dharma. This is the perfect definition. Whatever the world does, the opposite is Dharma, you know. So when we really go into this depth, we love to talk about compassion. We want to develop compassion. We love compassionate people, but to hear it to this degree, that we're aiming to have love for every single sentient being, period, and compassion for every single one, period, it's too shocking. But we've got to just see the logic of it. Then you can see the ladder up to it, you know. If it's just some kind of impossible feeling up there in the sky, you don't know how to get there. That's how we mystify it. That's why we mystify it. So we're going to go one step at a time, seeing the logic of it. I can't stress this enough. I really mean it. Then you get some courage in it. And then it's a question of just practicing, you know. There's no basis. So the equanimity one, there's no basis for hating one person, wishing they'd suffer, for adoring another, and for couldn't care less about the other. Because why? The logic is simple. It's like an equation, you know, because they all want to be happy and don't want to suffer. And all we're trying to do in equanimity is prove that point. That they all want to be happy and don't want to suffer. It shouldn't take too long. You just have to do a survey. And the answer, yes, I want to be happy. No, I don't want to suffer. There you go. They all agree. They're all the same. If we're really intelligent, we'd get it just on that. Oh, my God, I just got equanimity, you know. It doesn't take long if you really have a logical mind, I tell you. And you realize how foolish attachment and aversion and ignorance are. Are we communicating?
Yeah.
Okay. So then this leads us to this next hilarious, ridiculous point. And this is not really a meditation. It's just getting your head around it. You need your calculator for the next one. The next little point in these 11, which leads incrementally from this one. And that is, all sentient beings have been my mum. And you go, what is that all about? You know? So of course, as we know, because according to Asian tradition, you know, mummy is considered a kind person. I mean, many of us think that, actually, but we know in our culture, we almost think this is meant to make us miserable because maybe we can't stand our mums because we believe our mums created us, and because they're neurotic like us, and how dare they be because they're my mother, and they cause all my suffering, you know. Some people really can't stand their poor mothers, as we know. At some stage we all hate our mothers, maybe. Some people don't. I'm amazed when I meet some people who just adore their mothers. It's most unusual in the West. It really is. So they use the example here of a mother. But what's the point here? All sentient beings have been my mother. Well, again, this is a logical point to take on board as a hypothesis here. Given that Buddha would say there are countless trillions of sentient beings, literally, in all the universes, they'd say there's not an atom of space where you won't find sentient beings. In all the flowers, in the paper, in the cup, under your armpit, in your body, in your socks, everywhere. Trillions, in the air. You can't find anywhere where there aren't sentient beings. Buddha would say. First point. Second, being a sentient being, being a mind possessor, the term in Tibetan, sem chen, mind haver. It's a wonderful term for sentient beings, very direct. A possessor of a mind. So there are trillions of these mind possessors. Second, given that necessarily a consciousness, a mind, is beginningless, for the Buddha, logically, necessarily, logically. It's not like you can't see the beginning. Oh, well, must be no beginning. No, no, it's a logical conclusion from the logic of cause and effect. It's a logical conclusion. There has to be beginningless minds. And indeed, as the Dalai Lama said one time, I always quote this, you know, paraphrasing, that the universe, you know, we talk about big bangs. He says, yeah, no problem. Big bang, no problem. Just not the first Big Bang, that's all. So even the way they talk in the material, you know, in the Buddhist view, especially in the highest teachings, they talk about the physical world made up of the four elements, which is just like Galileo and our mob back in the Middle Ages talked, isn't it? Now we have about 1,000 different kind of elements, you know, but we're basically, it's the same model that used to be used, the four elements. So the physical world, to the Buddha, is made up of the four elements. Well, two, basically, the four elements are also beginningless. This is a bizarre concept for us. But the Buddha would say this is a logical conclusion from the concept of cause and effect. If you posit cause and effect, if you posit the concept of cause and effect, then by definition, you cannot have a first moment, ultimate first moment of anything, because that implies it is not the effect of a previous cause. So therefore, the idea of a first cause is literally a contradiction, is a nonsense. Let's think about just that point. Then we might like the idea of beginningless mind or beginningless universes, but it's, you can't argue with it. It's logical. But this is what Buddha simply says, you know. It's a logical deduction. Because, you know, this moment of my mind existing at this moment, we know it has to have come from a previous moment of something similar, this non-physical energy known as Rabina's mind. You keep going back. And you will never, ever go back a trillion years, 20 trillion years before this planet, before millions of other planets. You will never, ever, ever get to a point where you'll say, ha-ha, there's the first moment. We desperately want there to be a first moment. We desperately crave there to be a first moment. We are convinced there must be a first moment. It's absolutely irrational. Buddha says it's an absurdity in our mind, but we so believe it's true without analysis. As mad as it sounds. So, given this, it follows then logically, doesn't it, if all these sentient beings are in samsara, quote-unquote, that is to say their minds are imbued with delusions, that's the definition of being a samsaric being, so that means you're creating karma, that means you're propelling your energy forward, that means you're constantly creating different bodies and different realms and different bodies and different bodies, because that's the consequence of creating doing actions, mental actions, and having a physical body, the four elements, then it's logical that these trillions of sentient beings, get your calculator, if it's big enough, you have to deduce we bumped into each other countless times. So then it's logical they've all been my mother countless times. So the only reason we use mother is as a basis in the next couple of techniques, as a basis, as a reference point for a person who's been kind to me, nurtured me, looked after me, which is therefore a person we would like to, you know, to refer to as an example of kindness in order to open our heart to get to about the fourth point, which I'll get to, where we say, I must repay their kindness, which is a part of the steps of going towards love and compassion. But again, it's blowing our mind from the point of view of opening us up out of just a few people we love now. We first have decided they're all the same and they wish to be happy and not suffer. Now we're seeing that all these sentient beings have been a mother countless times. So the next, number three point, is to now think about the kindness of the mother. Well, I think this is a very powerful contemplation to do. Even, especially, you know, His Holiness often says, well, if you don't like the idea of the mother, think of anyone who's nurtured you, anyone who's loved you. Lama Zopa now says, when they usually talk about mother sentient beings, he often puts, like they do, both of them, all of them, mother and father sentient beings, because we're just so freaked out about our mums, you know. It's just it's an example that just doesn't work for our culture, because every person who goes to their therapist gets back to the mum being the blame. Why? Because mum is supposed to have created us, remember? So, of course, poor mums, you know, cop the lot. Or dads, isn't it? You get my point. But let's look at the logic of it. Especially, I want to say this, especially if you blame your mother. Let's look at why we should see her as kind. Just for our sake, especially. Let's look at it. Well, you know, I think the very first point here that blows my mind is the very way we use the word kind. First of all, you see a stranger, and you see them bending over, helping a dog, or being, even some people, some people even have an aspect of kindness. Their voice is kind. Their behavior is kind. Even if you don't know them, you can see that in general, can't you? What a kind old lady she is. Look at her, we'll say. We use it in that way, which is, seems reasonable. You can see a kind person, a sweet person, a soft person. That's a good example. But the other one is, which is a bit self-centered for most of us, you listen to this one. It's embarrassing, this one. If I go to the restaurant and I order what I'm attached to, let's say a delicious chocolate cake, and I want extra cream on it, and being rude, I'll ask for extra cream. And she will bring me extra cream, and I'll be a big smile, she'll want it to make me happy. She'll bring the extra cream with a really nice piece of chocolate cake, and then she gives me a discount. Guess what I'm going to say to her? Oh, you're so kind. And why was she kind? She might have been a creep. She just wants me a tip. The only reason I think she's kind is she gave me what my attachment wants. So you think that's what we mean usually by kind. You do what I want, you're kind. I'm sorry, it's true. That's why we turn against our mums when she stops doing what we want. Then we think she's the worst person in the universe. So it's just, again, unfortunately, with attachment, as long as a person does what I want, They may be mean as can be to the next door neighbor. I do not care. You're kind. So we really use it in a very self-centered way. And we use it to show, to indicate that we got what we wanted. I'm not being mean, but look at it, we'll understand this. Because we know if we look to more advanced levels of love and kindness and compassion, mummy can have tough love. We know that's a possibility. We know if you're a naughty kid and you don't do what mummy says and mummy really is kind, really sees your mind, really is trying to help you and she will be stern with you. We never think she's kind at that moment, do we? Because we mean by kind doing what I want. If we were really intelligent, we'd get it. Later we might get it. But we don't. We mean by kind when a person's nice to me and gives me what I want, which is the junkie in us that desperately needs that, like a hunger, you know. So it's not a very good way to use the word kind. Kind person, because you see them soft, that makes sense. So here, though, then, if it's true, let's say I had a creepy mother. Let's say I had a mother, all that means is she was very deluded. She had a lot of, my mummy had a lot of depression, for example. She had dramas in her life, you know, an abusive husband, my beloved father, whom I adore. But there was dramas in the family, lots of fights, he was alcoholic. Big dramas, you know, huge dramas, these non-human beings with these dramas. My mother would get deeply depressed and she'd ignore things. She was a lousy housekeeper. She had seven kids. My father would off be playing snooker, you know, pool, spending the money and drinking beer. But he was a gorgeous man. Everyone adored my father. Never said a bad word about anybody. So my mum was held with a burden, you know, to keep the family, earn the money. She was teaching music part-time, running the family business the rest of the time, trying to bring up the kids, sending us to the best Catholic convents. I think she still owes the bills. So, okay, the evidence was she was a lousy housekeeper, my mother. The clothing would pile up sort of 3 feet high, you know. We'd write all over the walls. We'd pee in our potties and spill them. We'd, you know, it was like because the lavatory was outside, we were scared of the boogeymen outside, you know. So it was like she was a chaotic housewife. She was a disaster, my mother. It was very funny. We were so ashamed when our posh girls from school, we went to this posh convent, they'd come home and one time they, you know, and I was so embarrassed to show our dirty house. And 40 years later at some school reunion, one of the posh girls said to me, "Oh, Rabina, we loved going to your house. You were so bohemian." We just thought we were dirty. Bohemian, okay? And I remember going to one of these girls' houses, one of the posh ones. I thought I was in a hospital. It was so clean. I was just, and there was about one person. There was no noise. Everyone was behaved nicely. Everything was clean. I really thought I was in a hospital. I just wanted to go home again, you know? It was very funny. What you used to. Okay, my mummy. On the face of it, I can tick off lots of problems she had. She was a lousy housekeeper. She was overwhelmed by work. She couldn't delegate well. She needed us kids around all the time to take care of her. You know, she'd be teaching music until 10 o'clock, so all these students would come and learn singing. She's a classical musician. And she wanted us to brush her hair. And she'd always make sure one of us went in to brush her hair, you know. We were like these little servants to make our poor mummy happy. I'm not being mean about it. I adore my mother. So in many ways, I can see she really had failings. That's objectively true. So then as I got older, of course, you go against your mother, you get mad at your mother, you rage at your mother, you hate your mother. So then how, if within that, and then the trouble is, you see, the trouble is this. When we have attachment, we only see the good things. So when I was a little girl, I only see the perfect. I remember my mother as perfect. But then as you get older, you start getting rude and you start to hate your mum. And before you know it, anger takes over. And now all you see is the bad things. And that's the biggest problem with attachment and anger. We never see the accurate picture. When you hate a person, you don't remember any of the good things they did. Suddenly, the whole person is now ugly, isn't it? We are like this. So it's very good exercise for our mind to remember the good things that our mother did, even if she was an alcoholic, even if she didn't pay the bills, even if she was unkind and mean and hit you. This is a shocking thing, but it's very powerful to do. Now, one of the best ways I think of this one, I know myself. In your life, you're mean to some people. People hate you. You hurt them. But you know, when you do one bad thing to somebody, and they now hate you, and all they do is think the whole of you is bad, you know how unfair it is. Do you understand my point? Because you know you did all those other good things, but they forget. That's what attachment and aversion do. They're very cruel, and they don't see the whole picture. So for me, it's a great example, a great practice, to, especially if you don't like your mother, especially if you blame your mother, it's very humbling practice to remember, literally to start since you're a tiny baby. Now, this brings us to the real point, I would suggest, what's meant here, the meaning of what they mean by she is kind, or any person's kind, this is the second, next point, is not that she made you happy, not even that in her nature she was sweet, but the fact that she did anything that facilitated your life, wiped your little dirty bottom, gave you food, sent you to school, showed you how to tie your shoelaces. Simple things we take for granted. And we don't think that's kind, you see. We just think, what do you mean? It's her job. But the fact that she did them is the simple meaning of being kind here, which is not how we think. Not at all. But it's very powerful to think this. Then immediately you know yourself if that person who used to adore you now hates you because of one thing you did. You know for them, you know what an amazing, blissful relief it is if they come to you and then remember, well, you did do this in them, and I do remember your kindness, and you were kind, even though, you know, I'm trying to forgive you for that bad thing, but I remember your kindness. You know it's true. But this is the trouble with attachment and aversion. They exaggerate. They blind us. Attachment blinds us from seeing the bad things, and aversion blinds us from seeing the good. So they're not realistic. So it's an incredible exercise to do. To think of your mother, for example, since you're born, since you were conceived, you know. Now, then, some people might have been given away by their mums. Lots of people are given away. Then we would definitely say there's no reason to think of anything she did was kind. Well, you're wrong. I'm sorry. She didn't abort you. Lots of mummies, including me, abort their babies. Lots of mummies have the baby, give it away. Well, you didn't get aborted. It's a fact. If someone runs out onto the street and saves you from running over, you'd never forget them. As long as you live, you'd be grateful. Well, your mummy did that to you. It's a fact. She didn't kill you. And it's an easy thing to do now to have abortions. That's a really serious point. But because we're so overwhelmed by hurt and pain and resentment, and she gave me up and she doesn't love me and you feel abandonment, that kind of thing, we never would think that she did anything kind. Well, it's just not true. It isn't true, you know. So it's very sobering to think this way. And again, get past the emotion. We're talking facts. Fact is, someone, even if it's not your mum, you want to use someone else, you're still alive because since tiny baby, someone nurtured you, gave you food, fed you, clothed you, educated you, took you out of the sun, took you out of the cold. Yeah, they might have beaten you too. They might have. So it's not because they're sweet. And it's not because they look kind, and it's not because they do what you want. They're kind because they did it at all. It's a logical basis for remembering the kindness of a person. In other words, all it is a technique for us to open our heart, to see something good about somebody. That's what we're doing. All we're doing here is using this as an example of a person to see them differently and open the heart. That's all we're trying to do here, all the way to Buddhahood, is open the heart, break down the misconceptions of delusions, break down the projections of the delusions, the ego voices, see things differently. That's all we're trying to do here. This is a series of techniques to open the heart, to break down barrier between self and others. Are you with me, people? Okay. That's why I say such intense stuff, you know. And you can't, it's not a gooey feeling we're talking. We're using logic to argue with ego's entrenched misconceptions, which we hold on to so strongly. And it's scary to do things like this. It's terrifying to start to see something good about a person you've hated all your life. It's completely terrifying. To start to love your father who might have abused you, you know? To start to forgive your father. And that's why forgiveness doesn't come as a mental factor in the states of mind that they talk about. But forgiveness is naturally incorporated into love and compassion. Naturally. It would come naturally. So my father, you know, he abused his daughters. Who cares what words you use? He abused his daughters. It's a fact, you know. I adore my father now. I love my father. I accept what he did. I have logical witness and other reasons, but I could see his good qualities. He did bad things, but he did good things. And this is very hard for our minds, because we want a saint or a sinner. You know, we would love to have people we hate or we adore. And it's just too extreme. It's too neurotic. It's not accurate, you know. It's not accurate. You know yourself how painful it is when people see you as a monster based on one or two actions. It's just not accurate. And that's what we're trying to do, is be, and this is wisdom as well, be accurate. What time are we? I'll go to one more point, then we can have questions. Okay. So this is, equanimity is one. All beings are mimi mum, two. Kindness is a mother, three. So that's 3A, now there's a 3B, okay? And this is the one that they often say in this tradition that is a more dramatic, more marvellous logical reason, logical basis to use for seeing, for developing kindness, for opening the heart. And that is to say, it goes like this, all sentient beings have been kind, are kind to me. On the face of it, this is even more ridiculous. So again, what's the logic here, okay? This is really based on the concept of interdependence, that everything is interconnected. It's very clear. You'll see it in a minute, you know? All it's saying is, this is my way of putting it, that there's not a single thing that's facilitated our life from the first second of conception up to now. There's not a single thing that we've had, seen, tasted, used, that's facilitated our life that hasn't been the product, the handiwork of countless sentient beings. That whatever facilitates our life, what is the cooperative cause for us to exist as a human being, the food, the clothing, the temperature, the things, the carpet, the couch, my glasses, you know, your underwear, your socks, your bed, the table, everything that facilitates our life, everything that eases the burden of living on this earth, that makes it easier, everything is the handiwork of countless sentient beings. So the same logic about kindness. We would never think the person who made, I would use my socks as an example, who makes my socks is kind. The socks are a complete joke. The only person who's kind is if it's my beloved who made my socks by hand, thinking of me. Then they're kind, you know, isn't it? So this one is, again, it's a logical one, and it's not the one of kind, sweet person, because lots of people, because, you know, psychos work in factories making socks, don't they? They've got to work too. Mean people who cheat and lie, but that's not the issue here. All we're trying to do in these techniques is break down these unbelievably outrageous, artificially created barriers between others and me. That's why they're so outrageous. Listen to this. This is insane. We're heading to the Buddhahood, right? Buddha says, actually, when it finally comes to all the realizations, that this actual way we entirely exist, that all sentient beings have, this actual experience of being a separate person from others is a result of delusions. So the dramatic thing we're trying to do on the compassion wing, in the wisdom wing, you're kind of playing safe. In the wisdom wing, you're really backing away from other sentient beings. Get out of their heads, back off, leave them alone, don't hurt them, mind your own business, your mind is your business, work on your mind, control your body and speech, control your mind. It's the retreat mode, really. You're playing safe. You keep out of the way of sentient beings. Now, sentient beings are the grist for our mill. And all these techniques are ways of outrageously breaking down what Buddha would say are these totally artificial barriers that have existed for countless eons because of delusions, where there's me and there's you. And, of course, the yous are divided into friends, enemies, and strangers. Completely artificial, Buddha says. And this is what we're trying to do here, by using these logical arguments, step by step, in these seemingly simple little ideas that, in fact, are outrageous, to smash the barriers that delusions have created between me and you, between me and others, until eventually, at Tonglen, we actually turn it around, and where actually others become more precious than me. So when you hear the Holy Lama's talk, I mean, Lama Sabrimish, I don't know if you know him or not, but when he teaches, he talks about compassion the whole time. He talks about it the whole time. He talks about unbearable compassion. He never sleeps a wink because he's meditating all night. Roger said, he's attended, that for Sabrimish, sleep is a disgusting waste of time. They're qualified as yogis. They don't need sleep. But what propels them, this is why it's so outrageous, is this, as he calls it, unbearable compassion for sentient beings. When he had his stroke 4 years ago in Australia, I was there, and the people in the hospital, like the day he went to the Catholic hospital, he was like, I can't even find the words for it. Like, it's too weird. It's just, this is one example. There are so many of these holy beings, this holiness, these outrageous beings who've actually accomplished this stuff, you know. It was like, he was totally suffering. He sort of sounded like a drunk person, senile drunk. He couldn't talk. He was all puffed up from all the drugs and the stroke that he had. Right, he was paralyzed. Words, you know, you'd think he was a drunk. You'd arrest him on the street. Apparently, in the hospital, from the first day, the Catholic nuns were blown out because he was hysterically funny. He was cracking jokes about not able to walk and slurring his speech and not able to walk and go in the pond, had his walker, and he just was like, he's very, very funny. He had no anxiety, no dramas. He had this phenomenal compassion for all the nurses, for the people, for the workers. It was, nobody had seen anything like it. I thought he was mad almost, because it was so unusual behavior, you know. And it seems to me with these holy beings, because their whole thing is this outrageous levels of bodhicitta, and because they're totally capable of transforming problems into happiness, which is this outrageous level of all this genre of practices in this tradition of exchanging self for others, this radical ways of smashing delusions. So this is for them, like, they're joyful when they have problems. Geshe Sopa, I remember one wonderful lama in Wisconsin, one of Lama Zabalama Yeshe's gurus, he's a Sarah J. Lama, the same place as Geshe La. And he, I remember, you know, he's beaming, blissful being, one of the products of this system. And he said, bodhisattvas need their enemies. They say when you're a bodhisattva, for example, that you, when you get something, you give something, you feel like we do when we receive. Everything is opposite, you know. You'd much prefer to be around a creep who can't stand you. You'd much prefer to give than to receive. I mean, it seems so demented, you know, for us. And what they've done is they've radically removed these delusions, which the Buddha would say over eons we have, that have separated us from others, you know. So each of these baby little techniques are these outrageous attitudes that incrementally chip away at these divisions that we have created between self and other, you know. So this next little one is to see how there is nothing that you've got in your life from the first second of conception, even your egg and sperm in your mummy's womb. Mummy and daddy worked hard for that. Believe me, they might have had fun. That's your body, you know. So one thing I think we think, well, you know, I'm prepared to think of the people who made the cup and they made this and made my glasses. I'm prepared to thank them. But hey, this is my body. Back off, you know. Excuse me. Where is my body? Began with my mummy's egg and sperm. And then for that 7 months, apparently I was only in there for 7 months, so I was eager to get out, it seems. But am I in the mother's womb, right? For 7 months. What do you think? My mother, day and night, thinking about her little person in there. Eating all the right food. And what did she eat? I think she was a vegetarian at some point, but let's assume she ate fishes and chickens and cows and things, like most people, or some people. Then that meat went into her mouth, she chewed it, it went down, and then, like all the miraculous things of bodies, turned into her body. But guess what? It turned into my body too. Where's my body? This little fetus, 3 months, 4 months, 5 months, 6 months, 7 months, popping out. What is this little body? Where's my body? I'm sorry. It's all the cows and the fishes and the bulls. Plus the peas and the things, and all the creatures who died for the peas and died for the carrots. Trillions of sentient beings lost their lives, were eaten dead, you know, to produce what's called my body. Where's my body that isn't the body and the work of other beings? There's no such thing as anything to do with me. Excuse me. And look what happens when one mosquito wants to take us, and Amos Oprah says, one tiny, tiny drop of my blood. I mean, it's like mental breakdown, isn't it? My body. I remember, again, another lama, Kirti Sentra Rinpoche. He said some level bodhisattva, I forget, whatever level, of different stages of development, you know. For that bodhisattva, he said, cutting off their hand and feeding it to a starving animal is as inconsequential as a leaf falling off a tree. Now, we can't even find any way to comprehend that in our psychology. But it's totally logical in this way that it's described, you know. So that person, we have to deduce, not only has incredible compassion for the suffering animal, they also surely would have realized emptiness. They would have seen the absence of the fantasy eye, which is what, anyway, makes the compassion soar to incredible degrees. We are all capable of incredible compassion. We might even give our life for some person. If we have a close connection, like a baby or something, you know. But the instinct that grasps at the I, and then indeed at the mind, which is my body, is so primordial that you'd have to be a highly advanced practitioner to actually have no sense of ownership of this body. And if you saw a starving animal, and I've got to say this too, they're not just sentimental fools. If there's a butcher shop down the road, they would not cut their hand off. That would be very silly. But it's assuming there was no option, you know. So this starving being, such is their compassion to that suffering being. This is where it's inconceivable. Not their little pet. Not their pet. Any starving animal. Because of their infinite compassion that they've cultivated doing all these techniques. Plus the wisdom wing. As inconsequential as a leaf falling off a tree. Meaning the compassion was gigantic. No longer the barrier between self and other. But there's not even the assumption of an I there. Ego grasping gone, had to be gone completely. And that means, you see, that means they've still got a nervous system just like you and me. There would be what we call pain. But and this is the point that's shocking to us. Right now, this is hard to hear, we have so much pain when we have, you know, physical things go wrong. Because of ego grasping and all the delusions and all the primordial grasping of this body as me and mine for so many eons, the habit of attachment and grasping are so stupendous that, you know, it's just the horror of the thought of even a drop of blood, you know, so shocking to us. That's the extent of our ego grasping and self-cherishing and attachment. Whereas they've gone beyond all of this. So there would be pain, but this is the point. For them, the compassion for that being, as if they were their most precious child, is so huge. It overrides any thought of pain. Who cares, you know? Like irrelevant. It's hard to imagine this. But this is what Buddha says we are capable of when ego grasping and delusions are gone. It's hard to bear. Hard to think about it. Again, no reference point for anything remotely like this in our culture. So there's nothing, you think. And so this is a powerful one to apply every day. You go to the restaurant. You know, I'm attached to my coffee being a certain way. I'm attached to getting it a certain degree. I'm attached to the right amount of milk and the right amount of honey and the right colour bean, please. I want a mild bean, not a black, shiny thing. I mean, you get my point. I just have to look at the coffee and I know if it's right or wrong. So, all I've got to do is think. Just think right there. Control my mind. There's a kind person, the barista. Okay, she's getting paid. That's not the issue. She's doing it. Like a miracle, I got, you know, she's doing it. Then the person who made the beans. And then there's Mr. Starbuck himself. Then there's the person who made the machine. Then there's a person, then you start on this and you can't, you never end. You just never end. The people who made the counter, the people who made the sign, the Starbucks sign who drew the girl, you know, so we can recognize Starbucks. You just start to go at everything you look at, the sign, the cup, the coffee, the beans, the machine, the tap, the floor, the mop, the counter, the thing, the glass. It's the handiwork of countless sentient beings. You know, like the ads they do sometimes for those companies? And they have all the staff, all cheering, you know? Showing you it's not just some label, it's human beings. That's the idea, except there's a trillion more, you know. And this is interdependence. Everything is interdependent, but it's in relation to sentient beings now. Immediately. You know, like they talk about the always, there's a person they always refer to him as the always crying bodhisattva. His name is always crying. Because he was meditating or whatever, and he just had to think of a sentient being. You just see a sentient being and you go birds of tears, you know, full of compassion. That's when it's really realized. Based on the logic, now genuine compassion, genuine tears, genuine affection for sentient beings. I mean, these bodhisattvas would give their life at the drop of a hat if it were necessary and appropriate, you know. This is the level to which. This is why I'm saying it's so outrageous. I mean, just loving one person is hard work. Only because we have delusions, that's why it's hard work. So to get to the point of having no delusions, using all this logic to cut across all the barriers, one baby step at a time, people, don't get dramatic. Don't try to give your hand off. Don't try to cut your hand off too soon, okay? You better be ready for that one. But you can start with one tiny, tiny drop of blood. And if you test, and I've tested it countless times, if you let them have their fill and they leave, there is no pain at all. There's no itch. I can guarantee you. Do it as an experiment, you'll see. Anyway, now questions. We've gone 4 points up to heading towards bodhicitta. We haven't got there yet. So any questions now on anything at all I'd like that I've been discussing?
I have one question when you said we should love our enemies and people do bad things.
That's right.
What about somebody, for example, who steals? When we just show compassion, he keeps stealing.
No, you say, okay, right here, what we've got, you're assuming compassion is kind of a let them get away with it, the poor thing, they can't help it. That's not compassion. That's not compassion. Real compassion has got real wisdom, which means like the wise mother, you love your child, you know what's best for them, and you have the courage to tell them off if necessary, because you genuinely want to help them. That's real compassion. The compassion, when we say the word compassion, sounds like sentimental, poor thing, can't help it. That's not compassion. Compassion is actually not enough on its own. It's got to have wisdom. It's got to be sound and grounded, and it means knowing how to help that person, if you can. So it's way more than just letting them. Well, that's not nothing to do with it. So if a person does steal, okay, if it's your precious child who steals, because you have such love for your child, it would be heartbreaking, wouldn't it? But you know it's the wrong thing, you're sad for them, you don't want to upset other people, so you'll do everything you can to help the child for their sake as much as anything, wouldn't you? Wouldn't you do that? Well, that's the attitude we're trying to get to realize it's for the sake of the other. You do what you can, and that could even mean putting them in prison. Do you understand what I'm saying? You've got to, but that's wisdom, not just coming out of anger or fear or attachment. Many mummies have such attachment for their child, so they let them get away with murder. That's not compassion. That's called attachment. That's completely not helping a person at all. Do you see what I'm saying? But very often, we see someone do something wrong in the world. Look at the world. But there's sometimes nothing we can do to help, which is heartbreaking, but there's just nothing much we can do. So compassion, again, so we've got to look really clear at what we mean by compassion. This is a general idea, but to be really precise about what compassion is. In the beginning stages of practice, where you cultivate what they call renunciation, which sounds very forbidding, but it's just meaning got two parts, by looking at karma, understanding the Four Noble Truths, you get a really sound grounding in understanding your own suffering. So in order to do that, we've got to get our definition of suffering, which is much deeper than we think. Suffering is the first kind, is when the bad things happen. The second kind of suffering is when the good things happen, because it's caught up in attachment and all the delusions, being caught up in depression and worries and attachment, even though if you're rich and beautiful, that's a level of suffering that's much subtler than the gross level of suffering. You understand what I'm saying? The attachment of the delusions. We've got to get in touch with that ourselves. Absolutely have to know about our own suffering, taste our own garbage, really be sick of it and want to get the hell out of suffering. And that, the other part of renunciation, that's the first part, be sick of suffering. But the second part is crucial in the Buddhist view, that is you've got to know why you're suffering, what are the causes. And of course, as we know from the Buddhist teachings, karma is the main cause and our own neuroses. So our past actions and our delusions, they are the root of the problem. So renunciation is a combination of you being sick of suffering, which implies ever more deeply involving your own mind, seeing all the delusions, being sick of them, seeing how they cause you problems, seeing how they make you unhappy, seeing how they make you have problems with your family, sick of this and wanting to change it. Broadly speaking, simply speaking, that's an example of renunciation, which really is compassion for yourself. It's like, you're sick of this and I'm going to change. It's like you smoke too much and you're sick of it and you want to give up smoking. That's a sort of an example of renunciation. We're talking here the mind. You understand? That's renunciation. So when you've got that for you, that's the wisdom wing. That's the basis for now having genuine compassion. So you look at others and you realize we're all in the same boat. There are these maniacs, the stealers and the rapists. There are the victims of the maniacs, who indeed are the usual ones we think are suffering. But when we have this deeper view of what suffering is and what causes it, we will have compassion for the stealer. We'll have compassion for the rapist. We might put them in prison, but because we know that they're causing themselves suffering, and they will only suffer unbearably in the future because of their own ridiculousness. That's the basis of real compassion, which comes slowly. It's outrageous. Do you understand what I'm saying? So if we can do something to change, which is what, this is where we get into more dramatic level of compassion. Okay, as we move up the steps, we get to where we eventually do this practice called Tonglen, which we're going to have to talk about next Monday. This technique of exchanging self for others, which brings these outrageous levels of compassion and love. But in the Bodhisattva path, there's another level of compassion and love on top of ordinary compassion and love. So compassion is generally, oh my God, look at that person harming another, and you have compassion for them because you realize they're harming themselves. And that's a tough one. We have it for our kid who's a junkie. We know our stealing son or our junkie daughter is harming herself. We know that. You get my point. And that we can see easily is easy to have compassion for a person you adore whom you see is harming themselves. That's the real meaning of great compassion, a big compassion, strong compassion. You see not just the victims are suffering, but even the person who's doing it is harming themselves. This is a crucial point of compassion. Are you with me? So then this extra level of compassion in the Bodhisattva path is called great compassion, which is the unique one of the Bodhisattva path. So normally speaking, if we look at the Hinayana path and you're aiming to accomplish the realization of emptiness, get out of samsara, achieve your own realizations, and you're done, you're cooked, you've achieved nirvana, you're finished, okay? But the Bodhisattva one is, okay, so over lifetimes and lifetimes, they say what the main motivation, the main goal for that practitioner is the wish to get out of samsara, liberation, the wish to be liberated, the wish to be liberated. That's the goal, okay? So everything is motivated by that. Everything is motivated by that. That's the motivation between all their actions, to cease samsara. So now, as that person progresses, naturally, as they get rid of attachment and rid of anger and rid of jealousy, they're going to get incredible love and compassion. It's not as if you just get rid of attachment and have nothing left. The more you get rid of attachment and anger and jealousy, the more love and compassion you develop. It's just a natural consequence. So this Hinayana Arhant, who's got infinite, who's gone beyond delusion, completely cut the root of delusion, is completely in the nature of bliss, has infinite love and compassion for sentient beings. But the point is this, when they go to die, this is because of their motivation life after life, their bliss and their compassion and love are overridden by their compassion and love are overridden by their motivation. I must get out of samsara. So that's what cuts their being reborn. They zap into nirvana, you know, zap into bliss. They don't get reborn. They have love and compassion. But the Bodhisattva practitioner doing the same work have added a component to that compassion. So not only do you see suffering and find it unbearable, not only do you see sentient beings and want them to be happy, hugely, you've added this extra component, which is called great compassion, great love, if you like, and it goes like this. You see suffering, and you go, compassion is, oh my God, that's unbearable suffering, look at this. Or even you see that the stealer stealing, you have compassion for them. Great compassion, which is this unique characteristic of the bodhisattva, the unique one. It's the one that says, what can I do to help? It's this huge, this is the unique one of the bodhisattva, this huge, brave attitude of responsibility, that it's my job to do it. If I don't do it, who will? This is the huge one that motivates the bodhisattva. So it's expressed as, what can I do? That's called great compassion. What can I do to help? What can I do to help? The other one, the Hinayana Ahant. You have compassion, you have love, but the main motivation is to get out of samsara. So when you die, that's the programming. You cease being reborn. But the bodhisattva will naturally be reborn, only wants to be reborn, to come back to the garbage dump of the world and all the garbage dump of suffering sentient beings, because there's this enormous sense of being cultivated in all these stages of development. That's why it's so outrageous, this bodhicitta. It's this outrageous level of a phenomenal love and compassion, that it's my job. If I don't do it, who will? And that's when it gets to bodhicitta, which we'll talk about more next week or whatever. Are we communicating here?
Yes.
Okay, good. So this one of what can I do, that's the unique one. It's like the one of a mother. You're seeing your daughter drown. Compassion falling out of your ears. You're so full of compassion. But you don't sit there wondering who's going to save her, do you? Even if you can't swim, you're in that water. You know it's your job. That's the one of the bodhisattva. It's my job. And it's a massive one. It's a huge one, a scary one, because we're happy to have compassion. But our trouble is this, okay? As soon as we see all the suffering, and it is unbearable, we assume we can't do anything about it, or we try desperately, and then we kill ourselves because it just gets too much. And this is the one of never giving up. His Holiness says, bodhisattvas never give up. They think in terms of eons. And we're not at bodhicitta yet. We're not even at love and compassion yet. We're getting there. There's this massive, courageous attitude of never giving up, never giving up, never giving up. You get love and compassion. You then get great love and great compassion. What can I do to make people happy? What can I do to take away their suffering? Which is what causes you, even if you don't need to be reborn, in terms of your own realizations, you will choose to be reborn, because the suffering of others is unbearable. And if I don't help them, who will? It's like that, they say. So then, eventually, this gets to this is where bodhicitta kicks in. So when you get to Tonglen, which we'll do next week, the few extra techniques and get to Tonglen, what this brings is this outrageous reversal, this paradigm shift in the mind, where it becomes genuine, not just momentary, but genuine and stable. The first moment of bodhicitta is then what kicks in, and that's this change, a fundamental change in the person. This person, for example, they say one of the signs of bodhicitta is there's no longer the thought, the ordinary thought of I. How we have I as our central player. We can't conceive of a world that doesn't have I as the central player. They don't have this concept. They're not stupid. They know their name. Who are you? Well, I'm not sure. Not like that. But it's no longer the neurotic I. No longer that. They say there's one of the signs of a bodhisattva is they no longer ask for anything for themselves. It doesn't arise in their mind. They're not suppressing it, hoping someone will offer them chocolate cake. It just doesn't arise in their mind, you know, because they're putting others first, naturally, naturally. It's hard to hear it. It's hard to imagine it's possible. So, okay, you have compassion and love. Then you have this great compassion and great love. You've made this paradigm shift. Others are now totally for you, in the front of your mind. They say that bodhisattvas never stop thinking about others. It's their job, like a mother for a precious child. Not in an anxious, neurotic way, but they know it's their job. And this is what bodhicitta gets, this is where bodhicitta kicks in, is that it's you go, oh my God, look at that suffering. Then you go, what can I do to help? And then you go, well, I'm not qualified yet, not much. So this is what, when bodhicitta kicks in, it's got two parts. And we're leaving you here until next week. One is, you never stop doing what you can according to your capability to help sentient beings, never stopping. And two, the long-term one is you never stop continuing to work on yourself in order to achieve Buddhahood, because very simply, then you will be qualified. So bodhicitta becomes the basis of everything you do. They say even the breath of a bodhisattva is imbued with kind of with this compassion, you know, bodhicitta. So bodhicitta is not technically compassion. We use it a bit it's not technically compassion. Compassion and love give rise to great compassion, great love, which then kick in and become this very specific thing called bodhicitta. This never stopping working for others because of great compassion, and never stopping becoming a Buddha because of compassion. Like, you know, like I use the example sometimes. You know, you go to Nepal, you see all the people with cataracts. Oh my God, look at that suffering. This is unbearable. And then you go, how can I help? And then you check, am I a surgeon? And you realize you're not. Well, you can't do much. You just don't go, oh well, okay. Okay, you can ask another surgeon, but the point is here, we're taking responsibility. So you come home to where are we now? I'm going to say Santa Cruz because I told the story in Santa Cruz. We're in Raleigh, thank you. You come home to Raleigh. I must become a surgeon. So you still, you know, go to have your dinner and you go to sleep and you have your boyfriend, you do this and you do that. But you say to yourself, why am I here? Oh, why am I back in Raleigh? I'm going to be a surgeon. Why am I doing that? For the sake of all the poor people up in, you know, the mountains waiting for me to fix their eyes. So then everything you do will be to help you become a better student so you can become a surgeon, isn't it? Why? So you want to go and help all the people with their cataracts. So that's what, I want to become a surgeon is I want to become a Buddha. Why? Because people are relying upon me. So this is your motivation for everything you do. Why you go to sleep? I'm going to go to sleep because I need to sleep so I can go to school tomorrow and do my studies. Why? So I can become a surgeon. Why? Because all the people need me to fix their cataracts. You kind of hear my point? Become a surgeon means become a Buddha. So then when you've got bodhicitta, when you've got the first moment of it, and it grows and grows and grows, this person, no longer the thought of I, no longer the thought of, you know, just wanting something for yourself. You might get tired, but you have your sleep. Why? So I can be healthy to go to school tomorrow, so I can become a surgeon. So you never lose sight of your goal. That's when bodhicitta is inside you. You never lose sight. But if you suddenly forget why you're going to school, because you meet some handsome boyfriend, and you suddenly stop studying, you forget your goal, because you didn't remind yourself every day why you're doing it. And that's how we can put bodhicitta into the mix in every day in our life. We're nowhere near actually being bodhisattvas. That doesn't matter. You start with a thought. And they say the powerful karma of the motivation is the key factor that determines the character of the things we do and say and think. So the more powerful our motivation, the more powerful the long-term results of our action. So then to have your dinner with bodhicitta, it sounds peculiar. How can I don't have much love, you know, how can I have bodhicitta for eating my dinner? But you can remind, you think, why am I eating? So I can be healthy, so I can help others, so I can become a Buddha. That's eating with bodhicitta. Why am I going to go to sleep? So I can be healthy, so I can help others, so I can become a Buddha. That's sleeping with bodhicitta. You're going to have sex with your boyfriend, make him happy. Why? So I can be healthy and happy, make him happy, have a good friend, so I can help others, so I can become a bodhisattva. I'm serious. I'm real. It's true. Then you have your set of attachment being your main motivation, which of course it is. It's the default mode. But you put bodhicitta in the mix. You stick it on top. And so soon, guess what? You get into the habit. And that's how you develop bodhicitta in the mind. And this is Lama Zopa, for example. These lamas are never stopping trying to give us these methods, these simple methods for how to transform ordinary life into the path. That's what it means. You change your motivation. In the beginning, it's phony. Of course it is. What do you think? Everything's phony when you first start it. You've got to start with the thought. Remember it every day. And slowly, it becomes real for you. Slowly, you'll act like that. Any other questions before we go home? Does it make sense, people?
Yes.
Okay. Yes.
I have one question.
Go going.
If who we are, if who I am is my thoughts, when I die and I'm reborn, what is it that is me? What is the self?
Me or self is just, what's your name?
Patrick.
Patrick is the name for this me over there, isn't it? Rabin is the name for this me here. So, okay, first we establish ordinary phenomena. So would you agree the name of this phenomenon is a cup? And this phenomenon is a couch. And this phenomenon is a person. Would you agree with that? It's just the name of a phenomenon, yeah? Well, self, I, person, they're all synonymous. You understand? A person is an I. The term we use for a person when it's this person is an I, is I, isn't it? So there is a conventionally speaking Patrick sitting on that chair. The Buddha's saying our problem is we assume and we think, although we don't realize it, there's some kind of bigger, deeper, fatter, more real Patrick in there somewhere. So we kind of exaggerate our Patrickness. We exaggerate our I-ness. We over-exaggerate our I-ness. We don't realize we do this. And so in that sense, there's not that exaggerated I. But your mind stream, as it continues, after it leaves Patrick's body, and the package known as Patrick is all broken into pieces like Humpty Dumpty, you understand, all finished, gone, the continuity of your consciousness, carrying all the imprints of everything you ever thought or done, it never can go astray, this is a karmic process, then you program this consciousness, and it will soon, let's say, if you live a decent life and kind to other people and don't harm them, and you die a happy death and you're very virtuous, then you've programmed your consciousness with lots of virtue. So this consciousness, which is now finished in Patrick's body, no longer has the label Patrick, but it's carrying the continuity. It's a continuity of mental moments that thrusts forward, will then find its way, let's say, to a nice new mummy in Raleigh, and now you get the name Mary. So Mary's just a label for another package, this time a girl shape, was the same continuity of mind that was Patrick's, and before that was the dogs, and before that was the God knows who. So the name I is a relative term we use for whichever you are in this time. You know, that's all, whether it's a dog or a human or a male or a female. But the continuity of consciousness is the basis of that label, that's all. Is the basis of the new package, you know. There's Mary's mind and body, which is a combination of the two bits, but mind and body. Now we label that person Mary. So the Mary splits apart and the body goes into dust and the mind carries on. And now, you know, because you're naughty as Mary, you turn into you go to a dog body. And now the new me is called a dog and you're called Fred or something. The continuity of the same consciousness. New karma's ripening, new experiences ripening. Does that answer your question? A little bit. A little bit. Food for thought.
Yeah.
Okay. This is Buddha's idea, baby. I can't tell you. I'm working with it myself, okay? I'm happy to tell you what he thinks. Someone else? No? Yes, sweetie. Boa. What's your name?
Marina. You said that everything we do, everything that happens in our life is because of our karma. Is there any way to recognize what our karma is so we can actually prevent things from happening?
I understand, yeah. Well, the starting point is like if you've never heard of botany, and someone tells you about botany, that everything in that garden out there is the fruit of a seed that you planted in that garden in the past. That would be reasonable, wouldn't it? Well, the first thing you'd have to learn, the very first thing, is the principle that seeds bring fruits. Wouldn't you agree? You've got to go learn botany eventually to learn all the nuts and bolts of it. But the fundamental principle is that everything that's in that garden is the fruit of a seed planted. So then you've got to. So the principle here is everything we experience, all the happiness, all the goodness, all the kindness, all the love, all the punches, all the kicks, all the meanness in our mind, all the experiences, every one of these that are my experiences, my mind, my body, my sickness, my health, these are the fruits of seeds planted in the past in my previous garden, in my continuity of consciousness. So the first principle is that one, which is a pretty big ask, because that we'd never thought this idea before. So the first one is to have that recognition. Then the next level of clarity, the next level of complexity that Buddha would get us to look at is the fundamental one that negative actions bring suffering and positive actions bring happiness. It's a simple principle, okay? That one. So a fairly easy definition of a negative action, the Buddha would say, is any action that harms another. Killing, lying, stealing, bad-mouthing. And this is pretty easy to prove if you look at yourself. You understand? It's a fairly easy, about 10 little points he makes. So he starts with a simple first level of practice, and he advises, he suggests that sentient beings, you don't kill, you don't lie, you don't steal, you don't this, you don't that. Why not? If I'm a Christian, it's because God said so. But for the Buddha, it's because he has found to be so. It's a conventional truth that sentient beings don't like being harmed. And we can prove that pretty quickly. Would you agree with that? So he would define that as a negative action. There's nothing coming from on high. So his first recommendation for the first level of practice is back off and don't harm sentient beings. But the reason he would suggest that, and this is his view of karma, you go a bit more deeply into it, and he says if we unpack what's going on inside me when I do an action of killing the mouse, punching my husband, loving somebody, I'm going to see there's various components in that action. The one, the crucial one, is it's my intention to do it, but underneath the intention is a reason or a motivation behind it. Do you understand? So he says most of the things we do in daily life are motivated by attachment to get what I want, or aversion because I didn't get what I wanted. And then who couldn't care less? Indifference, these three main attachment, aversion, ignorance. They motivate most of what we do now. And he says that's why most of what we do can cause suffering in the future. So the reasonable actions we do of kindness to others, that is kindness, but half the time it's only because we're attached to the person. It's still there. That's better than nothing. So we start to go more deep and more deep as we progress in our practice. First level is just abide by the law. Don't sow bad seeds. You play safe. Then you start to look in more deeply and go into it more deeply as you practice, as you study, as you learn this, you know, Buddha's view. You take it on board if you choose to. You become your own therapist. You go into your mind. You see the delusions. And then you start to unpack those gradually and begin to change your mind and stop doing negative things and giving up delusions. Then you get to the compassion wing and you keep progressing, keep progressing, keep progressing in this process. So you don't need, it's a long time before we actually can see exactly what action we did that causes this particular problem. Or good thing for that matter. But we can use the principles that are not, that if I have, you know, if I have suffering now, I can deduce it came from my doing a negative action. You don't have to know which one it was when. But as Buddha says, as you progress more dramatically on the path, you do develop clairvoyance. This is the natural consequence of anybody practicing, because your mind has that capability, and you'll be able to be very precise in seeing what caused what. But the fundamental law that that one uses as a Buddhist is the law of morality or the law of karma, that you don't harm sentient beings, because that will ripen as your suffering. So if I have suffering, I can deduce that I've done some harm to others. And they even have a list, you know, that goes through it in more depth when you study karma, that, for example, killing. The Buddha would say, there's four ways your past actions can ripen in the present. The first one is a type of rebirth, the human, animal, whatever. The second one is your tendencies. The third one is the stuff that happens to you. And the fourth one they call is environmental. So killing, for example, one negative action, if that ripens as a type of rebirth, you know, Patrick example, turn into a dog. Your mind will go to a dog body. I mean, there's no time to go into this too much here. That's called a suffering rebirth for all sorts of reasons. The second way your killing karma would ripen, and this could ripen in a human birth. We've got a human birth, and Buddha would say that's the fruit of phenomenal virtue in the past, that virtuous karma, morality and goodness practice in the past in the context of a spiritual practice programmed our mind. We died well, and those virtuous karmic seeds programmed our mind. No one does it to us. It's not punishment or reward. And our mind ran to a human mummy. So then we look into our life as a human. We can see many humans, the second way killing karma can ripen is as a tendency to kill. We can see humans kill, don't they? The tendency to kill. So if you have a tendency to kill, you can deduce the cause of that is because you've killed in the past. You've developed a habit to kill, you know? The ants, the roaches, the humans, whatever it might be. The third one is if it happens to you. One of the consequences of killing, the third kind of karma, is it happens to you. You get killed, you die young, or you get very sick. There's three, for example. So this is the basic principles of like Buddhist botany, I'm just talking, you know. So then you know, the first level of practice is, well, I know I don't want to get killed. Well, I better stop killing. I know I don't want to keep killing, so I better stop killing. I know I don't want to get born as a dog, so I better stop killing. It's a basic level of morality, like why you'd give up smoking cigarettes is because you discovered they cause cancer. Why you give up eating the wrong food because, you know, you get a bellyache. So it's the same kind of simple principle of changing your behavior first because you don't want suffering, because you're sick of suffering, which is what I said before is a very powerful one. Shouldn't just be seen as selfish. It's very reasonable because we're sick of suffering and we're using Buddha's view as our basis for interpreting what suffering is and what are the causes. And then we get to the more dramatic level here where we're trying to help others now. Do you understand? That's the approach. Marina. Yes.
Venerable Rabina, why, I keep thinking of the same thing and wondering why,
yes,
like in the Golden Light Sutra or in other prayers and all, it says, may I always remember my past lives. What, I mean, I think I'd be afraid to know what I've done in my past lives.
No, I mean,
what exactly does that mean?
Well, that would make sense, wouldn't it? If you forget that that cigarettes causes cancer, if you forget that the past habits of eating the wrong food and drinking too much alcohol and causes you suffering, if you forget that, you'll start the habit again because the habits are quite deep. It's very
reasonable. That's what it means.
Remember, not to make yourself miserable, it's just to keep yourself on the straight and narrow.
Oh, it doesn't mean that you have that clairvoyance or whatever to remember your past lives.
What does it mean? What does it say? What are the words? I can't.
May I always remember my past?
Oh, no, that is more. What? That is talking about. Huh? You have to show me the lines. I'm a bit confused.
Okay. I'll bring it in. Thank you.
Yeah, I can't quite place it. Then that's in the King of Prayers. Yeah, that's more to do with bodhicitta. That's more to do with bodhisattva. But, okay, bring it to me and show me. We can talk about it. So what else, people? Or is it time to go home? It is time to go home. It's 9 o'clock. Yes? Food for thought? Enough? Thank you very much. I don't know if I did what my job was. We haven't got there. We will next Monday, okay? So we think how amazing this 2 whole hours, non-stop, lots of thoughts, bucket loads of thoughts, lots of inputs in the mind. Take what works for us, take it home, think about it, chew it over. If it's useful, put it into practice. Keep trucking, keep working on ourselves, never give up. For our sake and for the sake of Mother Sentient Beings. Jang Chob Sem Chog Rinpoche Ma Kye Pa Nam Kye Gyo Chig Kye Pa Nyam Pa Me Pa Yang Gong Ne Gong Du Pa Ba Shog.